As we continue to try to contain the spread of the coronavirus, many of us are practicing social distancing and isolating at home. That can come with some serious challenges for victims of domestic, sexual, and child abuse. Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido discussed these concerns at a press conference just last week.
Being home, isolating or quarantining or working from home, living with an abuser, and the impact that that has on your mental and physical abilities.
We want to talk about that today, and joining us to do so is Maria Masaitis, who serves as the child advocate for Massachusetts. Maria, hello.
Hello.
Also with us is Lisetta Herge Putnam, who is the executive director of Independence House, a counseling and advocacy center on Cape Cod. They work to address and prevent domestic and sexual violence. Hello, Lisetta.
Hello.
So, Lisetta, let me start with you. How has your work changed since the coronavirus pandemic began?
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. We're used to providing what we call services on site at our offices, so in shelter and also in our offices on the Cape. What's changed is that our work has now moved to remote like everyone else. So we are still fully providing those services. But what we notice with the stay at home or stay in place order is that we're having survivors call us with more severe situations than we're used to hearing on a regular basis. So, of course, we're used to hearing severe situations, but this is closer together in time. And so what we're finding is that people are trapped, to use that term, in spaces with their partners or who are abusive to them. And we are having to think outside the box to be creative in terms of working with survivors on safety planning. So that's one of the most significant ways that we know our work has changed. I was on a call this morning with my program directors. And one of the things that was very dominant in our conversation was just the number of calls we've had that are so severe. And my staff is just really trying to think creatively with survivors about how they can maintain safety.
And Maria, you know, these are such intense and trying times. Can you kind of spell out for us the challenges that our particular situation presents for victims, and especially how to deal with that in a social distancing era?
Right. I think the situation for children is a little bit different, and that is because the entire American system of providing child protective services is heavily dependent on mandated reporters filing allegations of suspicions of abuse or neglect with the Child Protective Service Agency, which for Massachusetts is the Department of Children and Families. And one of the primary sort of filers, categories of mandated reporters are educators, whether that's teachers or whether that's early educators, people who are working in daycare settings. What we know is that in this sort of last couple of weeks, we have seen a 60% decline in the number of reports the Department of Children and Family has received. Now, there's always a little bit of a dip in the summertime when school is out. And actually, every year, like clockwork, when school reopens in September, there is an increase in complaints starting in mid-September and going to early October as children return to school, as teachers eyeball them, and as children oftentimes disclose things that are happening in their houses. And so our concern is that with everyone now physically distancing and children not being visible, that we don't know that there might be children out there who need help and who have not been identified. So for us, it's a similar situation that the children are not being visited or not coming to school. Although I think that educators and certainly for the state agencies who have existing relationships and client relationships with families and children, all of those individuals are reaching out virtually now, checking in either, you know, by some kind of a virtual communication or by phone, asking families whether they're okay, whether they need help. But this is a kind of scary situation for those of us who are concerned with child abuse because we don't know what we don't know.
Lisetta, I imagine there is something similar in terms of we don't know what we don't know and potential invisibility of the abuse for people who may be stuck at home and unable to safely get out and raise a hand for help.
Absolutely. I think that is one of the things that we are most concerned about is the safety of survivors of domestic violence who are stuck at home. And we know that isolation is one of the a major tactic of a person that uses violence and abuse in a relationship. And with the stay-at-home, stay-in-place order, that is like superimposed upon isolation that's already occurring. And while survivors in the before this may have had some opportunity to get out, maybe make an appointment to come see us or just walk into our services, they're having to plan more now. And depending on where they live, it may not be safe for their, you know, physical health to get out. So we have already, as of last week, the calls were down, but as of this week, they have increased and the situations are escalated.
Why do you think the calls were down last week, but are increasing this week?
Well, what we've determined is that survivors are feeling increasingly unsafe and they are desperate and are trying to figure out ways that they can be safe and not be in that situation. We believe that's the reason.
We spoke with Jill Zarakor. She's Children's Service Coordinator at Dove, which is a domestic violence organization in Quincy. She's been checking in with children and families via Zoom. Here's what she says she's concerned about.
My biggest concern is what's going to happen once we're back? And who are the people that aren't calling now because it's not safe, because they don't have a place to go, because everyone's in the home right now?
So I was thinking about that, Maria. Both in terms of the surge that you talked about that you're used to seeing in September, right, when kids go back to school. Lisetta saying people are getting desperate enough now, it's getting so bad they have to call. But also all that we're hearing about nonprofit capacity being badly damaged by the economic impacts. So if and when people do begin to be able to reach out for help again or we're becoming more effective at identifying cases, will we have the capacity to respond?
Well, I'm hoping that we will have the capacity to respond, although we are still, I think, on the state agency side, really focused on the day-to-day delivery of services. We have already started discussions that say when children come back to school, when things return to whatever the new normal is going to be, we are thinking about what's it going to mean. I think it's where the discussions are really centering around when schools reopen or when we are able to sort of, you know, meet with children sort of in person rather than virtually, of really thinking about the social and emotional needs and the trauma of this experience. I think that children feel the stress that families are under, and so they may hear their family members talking about being worried about money and food, and a family member may have already been laid off and lose their job. So the idea is that we're going to need to reintroduce children, address the trauma that they've experienced through this extraordinary situation, because for children, they also don't have the longer-term experience so that they can put this in perspective. For many children, this is the first big traumatic event that they and their community has experienced. So we are already in the process of thinking about what's it going to mean, how are we going to approach children who come back to school, and what are we going to need to do to reacclimate them to what normal life was before we really put the pressure on the academic return, right? We need to get their emotional health where it needs to be before we can then focus on a return to what we all want for them is, you know, a robust academic experience as well.
Lisetta, I want to shift gears for just a minute. Independence House also runs a shelter. And I want to ask,
yes,
you know, what have things been like there? Are you concerned about the virus spreading? And also, are you still taking in new people who may need shelter services?
Yes, we do have a shelter, and our shelter staff has been consistently showing up. We tried to get ahead of the COVID-19 as soon as the CDC started to put out their guidelines. And so with that, we've maintained space to quarantine. And right now, everyone in our shelter, which we've had the same, we're full. And so no one has left or is leaving, but we do have a plan for if people were to get sick in our shelter. And our staff are coming and going, so they are on the front line. So, of course, we're concerned for them. So the possibility does exist. And we are in, our mission is to support survivors and work with them to find safety. So, yes, if we have an opening in our shelter, we would do some work with assessing to see how we can safely, bring someone into our shelter using, again, all the proper guidelines that are in place. And that's what we do. That's what we're there for.
So to both of you, in this moment, what resources are available for people who are either aware of a child experiencing child abuse or people who are experiencing domestic and sexual violence? And what can neighbors and community members who are socially distant but may connect via Zoom or see people on a walk, et cetera, what can they do to help?
This is Maria. One of the things that we're trying to emphasize and why it's important that we have that the press publicizes is that for children and families, we are really trying to sort of focus on prevention activities. And we would like to sort of send the message that the sort of public agencies have stepped up, we have capacity, and that we are asking families to reach out and ask for help when they need help. That I think that what we're going to see in this crisis is that families who are normally not used to asking for help from public agencies may now need help. We are directing people to the 211 system, which is available on phones. You don't need to sort of access a computer or anything. And really asking people to sort of call 211, identify what their needs are. And there's beefed up support at 211 in order to be able to direct people to services that will be able to help them. On the children's side also, we're asking sort of community members to step up and be the eyes and ears, not just of the elders in their community, but also of children and families. And while keep maintaining the physical distances, we're asking people to check on families, particularly families with young children, to see if there's something that a neighbor can do to help them. For example, to when you're out at the store, to go out and pick up something for a family, because it's going to be really hard for families who may have limited transportation options to take all of their children out into the community to get a gallon of milk. And so I think being good neighbors, but also encouraging people that if they are either feeling stressed or having some material needs, to reach out and ask for help, because we want to prevent a stressful situation from turning into a harmful situation for a child.
And Lisetta, same question to you.
So, of course, because survivors of domestic violence and sexual violence come from all walks of life and all communities, we try to think about all of those individual communities and differences. So with that said, there are some similar resources that are available. So, for example, for people that are in community where they have neighbors, what we want to do is the same thing. We're asking neighbors to check in on your neighbor, ask how they're doing. If you particularly know of someone and you already know that they're in a domestic violence relationship or in a situation that is questionable, check in with them. Is there anything I can do? How are you doing today? And just provide them with that support. Let them know you can listen. You're there to listen. They may need you to make a call for them. So you can ask them, is there a call I can make for you? So that's in terms of community, that's one possibility.
I'm sorry, I have to stop you there. No, I'm sorry, Lisetta. I don't mean to be rude, but the clock is not forgiving. That's Lisetta Herge Putnam, who's executive director of Independence House. Thank you for your time today. And Maria Mosaitis, who serves as the child advocate for Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Thank you.